In order to control global warming, the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change estimates that greenhouse gas emissions must be decreased 40% by the year 2035. Last December, the world's leaders met in Paris and struck a landmark deal that required unanimous approval by delegates from around the world and, for the first time, commits 195 countries to lowering their greenhouse gas emissions. But some politicians have argued that our attempts to rein in carbon emissions will wreak havoc on the U.S. economy. Is that really the case? Well, according to Robert Pollan's latest book, Greening the Global Economy, a serious investment in reducing greenhouse gases will create new jobs and improve living standards across the globe, in addition to sparing the world a host of potential environmental disasters. Mr. Pollan is a professor of economics and co-director of the Political Economic Research Institute at the University of Massachusetts, and he has served as the energy and economic consultant for the U.S. Department of Energy, the International Labor Organization, and many other organizations. I spoke with him last December while the Climate Change Summit was taking place in Paris, and we are rebroadcasting that interview for you now. You quote the goals of the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change, or the IPCC, in your book. Who are they?
They are a United Nations-based organization and serve as a clearinghouse for all the latest research on what climate science is telling us we need to do to stabilize the climate.
So are they participating in the meetings in Paris?
Oh, very much so, yeah.
Do the IPCC and the participants in the Paris Climate Change Conference have similar reduction target goals?
Well, I think everyone would like to say nice things about getting the carbon emissions down, but the commitments that were made immediately prior to the conference by the 190 countries participating were commitments to reduce their levels of CO2 emissions, but they are nowhere close to being adequate to meet the IPCC's goals.
Which are to reduce emissions by 40% in the next 25 years and by 80% by 2050.
Right. So we're not even close. In fact, if you followed the commitments, and these are not themselves even binding commitments, but if you followed those commitments made by the countries, including all the countries, we probably would miss the 20-year target by 80%.
Al Gore made the case that we can reduce absolute energy consumption either through conservation or efficiency improvements. How much reduction can such efforts yield?
I think that actually is the single most important project that we need to undertake, in particular efficiency. Efficiency as opposed to conservation means you just use less. Efficiency means we get the same level of energy services with much better technologies.
Well, we are also talking about using less coal and oil, more clean-burning fossil fuels.
Right, right.
Natural gas being one of them?
Well, natural.
But the natural gas we get mostly through fracking, so
right.
Then isn't that another problem for many people?
Natural gas doesn't help us really effectively. Natural gas does burn about 50% cleaner than coal, but it still is emitting a lot of CO2 emissions. On top of that, as you just said, through fracking, the production process releases methane gas, which is even more potent in terms of greenhouse gas emissions than carbon.
In my previous conversation, I pointed out that Dr. James Hansen believes that nuclear is the solution, at least
right.
In the short term.
Right.
What are your feelings about
that?
No,
I don't agree with that. I think the solution is clear and twofold. Heavy investment in raising energy efficiency standards, and secondly, in expanding clean, renewable energy.
What about carbon capture and sequestration?
Also, I don't favor it. We don't have any evidence. There's no commercial-scale projects in carbon capture and sequestration. The technology has been around for 30 years, and the fact that oil companies, coal companies, if they could make it work, they would have it working by now, and it's not working.
What would that involve? You capture the gas, the carbon emissions, and then you bury them?
Exactly. You capture at the point at which the energy is being generated, and we're burning coal. You literally capture the CO2, and then you have to have a process through which you transport the CO2, probably through initially liquefying it, and then you have to bury it underground.
You could bury it right next to the nuclear waste.
Yeah. And in fact, the level of the technology needs are equivalent to having a whole new energy system.
How seriously is CCS being considered?
Well, I mean, certainly proponents of coal. I mean, for example, in developing countries, they say, look, coal is cheap. We want to keep burning coal. And if we have to use this carbon capture technology, so be it.
Well, does Mitch McConnell, who comes from Kentucky, a coal producing state, and who has been a major resistor of any kinds of changes in policy, does he push CCS?
I don't even think he pushes CCS because I don't think he takes climate change seriously one way or another.
My guest is Robert Pollin, P-O-L-L-I-N. His latest book, Greening the Global Economy, it is published by the MIT Press. This is WMIC, WMIC.org. I'm Leonard Lopate. You're quite optimistic that from technological and economic points of view, we can easily achieve the IPCC goals. But given the U.S. House Majority Leader Kevin McCarthy's announcement that the House won't commit taxpayer money to supporting a climate accord, anyone that's reached in Paris, what are the chances of meeting the goals?
Well, I think that the goals are technically achievable because investing in energy efficiency actually saves people money. Of course, we have to have the initial upfront financing, but it saves money. You know, within 3 years, on average, you get a full payback on your investment. Renewable energy, solar, wind, clean bioenergy, as your previous guest just said, the costs roughly, and this from the U.S. Department of Energy, the costs are at rough parity now with burning fossil fuels to generate electricity. So if we invest, and what my work is showing, in the range of 1.5% of GDP a year in the U.S. and globally, we can meet the emission reduction goals of a 40% reduction in 20 years.
Congress approved resolutions that scuttle the EPA's rules to significantly cut heat-trapping carbon emissions from existing and future coal-fired power plants. How does that affect the climate pact?
Not positively. I mean, clearly we need to do things at other levels. So for example, at the state level, at the municipal level, the state of California, which, you know, if it were a country, would be like the 13th largest economy in the world, has committed to reducing emissions at this 40% by 2035. And I'm optimistic they can get there.
Do you think it's because California had such a bad carbon situation in the past? I remember the first time I went there and you could see the air. And there were major concerns about that. And they started imposing all sorts of rules about cars and fuel emissions there. And now Los Angeles is almost a pleasure to breathe air in.
Well, I used to live in Riverside, California, which was the dirtiest air in the country, unfortunately, when I lived there. But it has been transformed. And so, yeah.
So it is possible.
It's possible, and people have to get behind it.
And polls indicate that 2/3 of Americans want the United States to join the Climate Change Pact. But their elected representatives are not responding to that?
Well, you know, the Republican Party today is vehemently opposed. But we need to remember it was only in 2007 President George W. Bush signed the Energy Independence and Security Act. So it was a bipartisan agreement that, among other things, did commit the federal government to reducing to raising energy efficiency standards by 30%.
And you lay out a plan for achieving the goals of the IPCC, decreasing consumption of fossil fuels by 2.2% each year, investing in energy efficiency, investing 1.5% of global GDP in renewable clean energy. Mm-hmm. They don't seem like
incredibly
expensive goals.
And in doing so, number one, it does not slow economic growth. So, for example, in India, we've heard from Prime Minister Modi saying it's immoral for the rich countries to tell us to slow economic growth. This does not entail slowing economic growth.
But India and Brazil are two of the main resistors to any real change.
Well,
they are major economies.
They're different. Brazil is actually a star performer today in terms of having low emissions per capita. India is low, but it's a very poor country, and they will get very high emission levels. And I just came back from India and was lecturing on this. We need to infuse there as well as here the idea that investing in green economy is good for jobs and good for growth.
Isn't India aware of the fact that its neighbor China is going through serious problems because of pollution there? Beijing is...
Delhi is worse than Beijing. Delhi is the worst in the world. I was just in Delhi. Yeah, you can't breathe in Delhi. People go around with masks now.
And yet that doesn't affect government policy?
It seems to have not penetrated seriously. And, I think it's going to change over the next few years.
Is most of the resistance from governments or from the industries? Because you say that the fossil fuel industry simply has no choice but to contract even before your plan is put into place, given global trends in divesting.
Well, of course, the fossil fuel industry doesn't want to contract. They have trillions of dollars invested in the ground, and they have no plan to give it up. That's why we need a political movement to counteract that.
Well, most of the politics right now is generated by people like, Exxon and the Koch brothers.
That's right.
Because that's where the money is?
Yeah. And they pay a lot of intellectuals to endorse what they say. And I've debated some of them, and they either dismiss climate change or they say it's not the most serious thing. We don't want to destroy communities, for example, in Kentucky. And of course, I don't want to destroy communities in Kentucky. That's why one of the things I argue for as an absolute imperative is so-called just transition. We are going to see the fossil fuel economy decline, and therefore we do have to invest in those communities and the workers that will be impacted.
The Times, thinking about India, the Times reported that the greatest threat to reaching a binding climate accord may be a loose coalition of developing nations led by India, who argued that they should not be asked to limit their economic growth as a way of fixing a problem that was largely created by the others, meaning Western countries after the Industrial Revolution. Do developing nations need to limit growth in order to reduce?
No. Yeah. That's my most basic point. And I was making the point in India only 2 weeks ago. There is no reason to think that India and countries like India, Indonesia, which I've also written about, have to diminish their growth project by building a green economy. Quite the contrary. Right now in India, 40% of the rural area has no electricity. The best way they can get electricity now is put up small-scale solar or wind systems that will serve their communities. And they will leapfrog over utility-scale fossil fuel utilities. And that's a development project. And it's a jobs project.
My guest is Robert Pullen, professor of economics and co-director of the Political Economy Research Institute at the University of Massachusetts Amherst. His latest book is Greening the Global Economy. It's published by MIT Press, and we will continue a conversation after this. We're back with a rebroadcast of a conversation I had with Robert Pullen about his book, Greening the Global Economy. Mr. Pullen is a professor of economics and co-director of the Political Economic Research Institute at the University of Massachusetts. I spoke to him last December while the Climate Change Summit was taking place in Paris, and I asked him how he responds to arguments that curbing carbon emissions will lead to job loss and will hurt our economy.
Coal miners will lose their jobs over time. That is inevitable, and we need to protect their livelihoods. But on average, investing in the green economy creates a lot more jobs than the fossil fuel economy.
So you don't see an economic downturn?
No, it's an economic upturn. We will get more jobs. In the United States, for every $1 million you spend, you get 3 times more jobs, 17 jobs by doing green economy investments as opposed to fossil fuel economy investments.
And you say in India it's a lot more, almost 262 jobs?
Yeah, well, it's measured in dollars, so that's why the number is high. But yes, you get basically in India as well 2 to 3 times more jobs because you're building a new sector and it's creating massive new opportunities.
Is there any country that would not see job creation as a result of investing?
Well, you know, I've done the economist modeling, cranking. We've done it for like 13 countries, including China, Spain, and so forth. It always comes out the same. It's not exactly the same, but it's always the same.
A number of European countries rely on nuclear energy, then Germany as a mix, although I guess they're cutting down on their nuclear dependence, but a lot of solar energy in Germany. Yeah. Some other countries have windmills.
Yeah.
Are we seeing major changes?
Well, look, in Germany, the single most important source of their very good performance with low emissions, half of the U.S., is that they're operating at a much higher efficiency level. It's more important than solar, more important than wind. They invest in energy efficiency. They subsidize it, and they run an economy at our standard of living, running with cleaner machines, basically.
When you do these estimations as to the advantages of switching away from fossil fuels, where do you get your data?
The data are from national surveys of how economies work. It's called input-output tables, but it's a fancy term that basically just means You survey businesses. How do you do what you do every day? How many workers do you hire? How many machines do you have when you turn on the lights? And we use those.
Economic growth requires access to inexpensive energy. Can renewable energy ever equal the affordability of oil?
On average, it already does. Not solar. But solar is coming down, as your last speaker just said so well.
We have to develop better batteries.
Yes, we do. But even with what we have, if you take the numbers from the U.S. Department of Energy, wind power, bioenergy, small-scale hydro energy, geothermal energy are already, on average, at the same average cost as coal.
Well, let's go back to Representative McCarthy's concerns, which involve costs. How much exactly will Americans need to invest in order to achieve the IPCC target emissions reduction?
Well, for the U.S. to get our emissions down absolutely by 40% within 20 years, I've estimated with my co-workers that we would have to invest about $200 billion a year. That's about 1.2%. Of current GDP. And it's not money taken out of the economy. It's money put in, and it's a job source.
Don't we already subsidize the oil industry?
We already do massively subsidize oil and nuclear.
And we just recently decided not to support the Keystone XL pipeline, but that oil is still going to come to this country through various means. Trains, for example, are carrying large quantities.
Yeah. So basically, the fossil fuel industry has benefited from massive subsidies for generations. Nuclear power has. And even with that, our cost level is rough parity now with renewables.
So we're spending as much on dirty energy as we are in clean energy?
Oh, way more, yeah.
I'm talking about government.
Government subsidies, yes, way more.
How do, and then there's the whole matter of environmental cleanups. Do we throw that into the equation?
If you include environmental cleanups, that would certainly, number one, enhance the environment. And also, by the way, it is a source of jobs. If we think about the Roosevelt administration, the Civilian Conservation Board, was very much a New Deal project to not just help the environment, but to be a source of job creation. We have to think in those terms.
Well, we have spent a lot of money to clean up the BP oil spill. We still are cleaning up the oil spill in Greenpoint, Brooklyn. Alaska had real problems with the Exxon Valdez, and then Waterkeeper points out that tar sands oil was spilled into the Kalamazoo River in 2010, and $10 billion was spent to clean that up and remediation. Is that ever discussed when we talk about the cost of switching over?
That's not even in my exact calculations. The thing I was just looking at was emissions. But yes, this thing, all these things also factor in, and those are a reduction in GDP. They're money that couldn't be spent on good things, and instead is spending on cleaning up the mess created by fossil fuels.
Aren't oil, gas, and coal companies exempt from bearing the costs of negative environmental impacts?
They have been to date, and that, you know, they need to be forced to do so.
So how do we turn things around? Congress seems to be totally resistant.
Congress is resistant, but at state and local levels, we have a lot of energy. We have a very strong emerging divestment movement to divest out of fossil fuel stocks and reinvest in clean energy. I think that is a very promising development.
So is this going to be a state-by-state thing?
I think it's going to be a state-by-state thing and a grassroots movement focused around divestment. For example, at my own university, University of Massachusetts, we want to divest from fossil fuels and reinvest in clean energy. If this catches on, and it already is over the, throughout the world, that's going to be a powerful counterforce.
Do fossil fuel producing companies receive subsidies in other parts of the world?
Oh, massive subsidies. I mean, you know, to the tune of something like $600 billion a year.
In what ways?
Well, you know, part of the argument there is it's, you know, so-called consumption subsidies, which is they make the price of oil and coal cheaper for people. And they say this, you know, this is an anti-poverty program. It is in the sense, but you could also just give people money or subsidize clean energy for them.
So you could just take the, instead of subsidizing the dirty energy,
yeah,
you can just subsidize these new efforts.
Subsidize.
But some countries that would not be possible.
Well, the countries, any country can subsidize people's living standard, and you don't have to do it through energy. So you can subsidize, you can give people money, and then you can have the renewable energy be cheap and the fossil fuel energy be expensive.
Well, do you think it would be likely that Saudi Arabia, which has that oil,
yeah,
would want to switch over to solar, even though it probably would be very effective there, or wind?
Yeah. Well, I mean, they are investing, but of course they are not going to be happy about giving up their fossil fuel assets. But that's just what's going to, they know it's going to happen over the next generation.
Should bigger, richer countries, which are using more energy, pay a steeper price?
I think the rich countries like the United States should, we should all pay a higher price for fossil fuels to reflect the environmental damage. Then rich countries should help subsidize the development of green energy in poor countries.
What's the difference between energy efficiency and energy conservation?
Energy conservation means we just use less. We don't fly airplanes as much. We don't use air conditioning. Energy efficiency means you have an air conditioner that runs more efficiently, or you use LED light bulbs as opposed to incandescent.
I was very aware of the irony in, when watching Al Gore in An Inconvenient Truth, where many of the shots were through the window of an airplane. He was flying on a jet talking about why we were destroying the environment.
Yeah, well,
but can we avoid it?
If
we want to travel, we either go by jet or we go by car. And unless we, there has been a lot of resistance to electric cars. We're selling 1/3 of what the projected number of electric cars last year. It was projected at 100,000 and 35,000 or so. So,
well, you know, I am much more optimistic and much more focused on efficiency as opposed to just doing with less. So I think we can certainly operate cars much more efficiently. In fact, under Obama, we've committed to doubling the level of efficiency for cars within 20 years. So by, on average, every person in by 2035 is going to be driving the United States the equivalent of a Prius at that level of efficiency. And that actually is a major, major advance that Obama got through. So that's the, you know, I don't want to ask.
Which
people,
might be reversed with another president.
Let's hope not.
How green is burning ethanol, which is a big issue during the presidential campaign because the first, because Iowa is so important in this whole process.
Corn ethanol, the prevailing kind of ethanol that we use now, is no improvement whatsoever relative to burning petroleum. But if we generate ethanol from waste products or from algae, agricultural waste, and we refine it through renewable energy, it's almost as clean as solar energy.
Bill McKibben was a guest on our show not too long ago to talk about an article he wrote called Green Energy Makes Utility Companies Nervous. Are the energy producers and utility companies opposed to renewable energy? Can't they just get in on the game here?
Well, they could, but number one, they have
a head start.
They have a head start, but they also have existing technologies that they want to use. And also, clean energy is going to create opportunities for non-utility sourcing, so-called distributive energy, like just putting a solar panel on your roof, like your last guest was talking about, and you cut out the utility altogether. They're scared to death of that. I mean, the Financial Times, hardly a leftist outlet, was making the point that, you know, the utility companies know that they are going to go the way of, say, landline telephones.
A lot of callers have been asking about carbon tax and carbon caps. Are they useful?
Yes. Carbon tax or cap would...
Should we not call them tax?
Let's just call them tax. It's easier.
Okay.
So it's... carbon tax would raise the price of our consumption of fossil fuels and would discourage us, therefore. And that's good. The problem is when we impose such a tax, it falls disproportionately on low-income people. So if you're going to do that tax, you must also then take some of the revenue or most of the revenue and give it back to everybody so that you don't, in terms of income, you don't suffer. And that would, with that extra income, that would encourage you to invest more in renewable energy.
I've read that we produce enough wind power but don't have the infrastructure to get it to the markets. Is there any truth to that?
Yeah. So we need to develop the technologies for storage of solar and wind and for transmission. That's part of the project. That's when I say 1.5% or 1.2% of GDP, all of that's in there. And when I talk about the costs of being at parity, that includes the transmission costs, though. So according, if you believe the U.S. Department of Energy, including everything, including transmission, if you're running a wind farm, on average, the kilowatt per hour cost to get electricity is the same as coal.
Wouldn't solar actually be bad for business for power companies? Because once you've installed the panels, they can't keep on coming back to you for more and more money.
Right. It would be an entire...
Is that why they're resistant?
Yeah. I mean, it's an entirely transformational way of delivering energy that people need. And so it will take these businesses and put them out of business.
What are some of the consequences of not hitting the goals?
Well, you know...
Have we gone past the tipping point, as some people have suggested?
I'm not a climate scientist, so I just go by what people like James Hansen are going to tell me. But the thing, as an economist, that I can say is, as an economist, we think, let's buy insurance. We don't, you know, even among the 98% of climate scientists who say we're facing an ecological disaster, they don't know exactly what it is. And I say, I don't need to know everything. I need to know what we have to do to have insurance against it, which means get our emissions way down. And what I'm saying is the insurance policy we need to buy is affordable.
And you say that it would actually create all new industries, create new jobs. Why do you think Mitch McConnell is not listening to you?
I don't think Mitch McConnell is interested in what I have to say because he's very happy with his job and telling the story he's telling that the coal companies like to hear.
Robert Pollin, he is an economist at the University of Massachusetts Amherst. His book, Greening the Global Economy, is published by the MIT Press. And I thank you so much for being on our show
Thanks so much for
today.
Having me. I really appreciate it.